What's up, what's up? Welcome to Black Healing Remix, the podcast. This is YOLO, and I have the pleasure of sharing with you our latest episode, which features some pretty dope folks, y'all. This episode is about exploring masculinity in the intersection of mental health, and we have Emmy Award and Tony Award-winning actor Courtney B. Vance. We have minister and therapist Dr. Robin L. Smith and Devin Michael Lowe, who's the founder of the Black Trans Travel Fund, all in conversation with me and Natalie about the intersections of this thing we call masculinity. What is it? How does it look? How does it feel? How do we define it? Through this discussion, we explored what it looks like to create safe spaces where Black men can connect with their full humanity, where we can reimagine masculinity, where we can expand masculinity, and just cultivate more joy and healing for Black men and masculine folks across the gender spectrum. It was eye-opening, it was dope, and I think you're gonna love it. Check it out, and don't forget to like and subscribe afterwards. Peace.
I have the privilege of introducing somebody who you probably have seen so many times that you think is your uncle. You're like, that's my friend. I already know him. And so I would like to formally introduce you to Mr. Courtney B. Vance. He is an award-winning stage superstar. You may have seen him in things like The Preacher's Wife or as Johnny Cochran in The People versus O.J. Simpson. Mr. Courtney B. Vance has won everything. He got 2 Emmys, a Critics' Choice Award, the Black Reel TV Award, multiple NAACP awards.
And he married Angela Bassett.
I just want to say, this man be doing all that and then some, and then also got the nerve to be married to Angela Bassett. I said, what can he not do? I said, so we got to talk to him about Black masculinity because he clearly knows some things, right? So, so excited to have you here. Appreciate you. Yeah. And we have some other amazing folks, which we'd like to introduce you to.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have the honor of introducing Dr. Robin L. Smith. Give it up for Dr. Robin. Come on up. Come on up.
I'm waiting.
Hi, darling.
Bless you. Thank you.
So, you know, it's interesting. Dr. Robin, first of all, on top of being a best-selling author, New York Times best-selling number one author, you know, and a licensed psychologist and a minister as well.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you something. Like, for many folks, you might know for me, Dr. Robin, well, like, I remember watching Dr. Robin on Oprah back in the day.
Okay.
Right? Like, you know what I mean?
And we was getting free. We was like, right. What she say? Let me
yes, write yes. And I remember I was like, who is this lady spitting knowledge on my life? You don't know me. What is going on? But in other pieces, I want to make sure I name as well. She's also the author of Lies at the Altar, The Truth About Great Marriages. That's all a juicy book.
So I feel like some of us need to get on today.
As well as Hungry, The Truth About Being Full, which we just had a whole conversation about this too. I want to bring that into space. She's also a sought-after speaker, experienced media personality, host of SiriusXM's The Dr. Robin Show. And she also is, of course, the co-author of the amazing book, which I'm really excited to talk to you both about, The Invisible Ache. And I would say one thing I would say, Dr. Robin, I appreciated it. When I was reading through the book, I was like, oh, wait, Dr. Robin's going in a little bit on the system. So I was like, oh, I like this. You know, I love the systemic analysis. She brings that kind of broader structural analysis that sometimes some of our mental health people don't always bring in.
Yeah.
So I want to appreciate you and welcome you to the stage.
Thank you
for being here.
Thank you.
And of course, our last guest will be joining the panel. We want to invite Devin Michael. Devin, come on up here.
Come on up.
Devin is a community organizer invested in the liberation of Black trans community. It has a whole bunch of analysis, go critique and tell us all the things that we need to know. Is the executive director and founder of the Black Trans Travel Fund, an organization that provides travel-based resources and Black trans women on a global scale.
Devin is also an OG being member. Like, before I was a full-time staff, Devin was helping us doing stuff. Like, we talked about this, and we've never met in person. So this is, like, really our first opportunity because we have been doing digital, really organizing and, like, and witnessing your brilliance and organizing across, like, across that time. So I'm just really honored to have you. Beautiful.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Okay, let's jump in.
Come on, let's jump in. Give a round of applause for our panelists.
I guess we'll sit down.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
yes,
welcome. Want to just invite you to get landed and grounded. One of the things that we always do at Beam, you know, y'all may be familiar with the feelings wheel. It is this beautiful, dynamic image with all the feelings, right? And in our work, we always invite people to practice naming their feelings because we recognize that for many Black folks, us being able to verbalize how we feel is very foreign. That might be a thing we privately do, but it's not something we get to do in public. And so as an act of rebelliousness, as an act of liberation, I would love to invite each of you to share with us what you're feeling in this present moment, recognizing that feelings are typically one word. So we don't have to tell the story, but you can just acknowledge, are you feeling excited, sad? And we can be with you in holding that experience. And it's an opportunity for us to not have to react, right? Very often if somebody says, oh, I don't feel good, we go, oh, girl, what's going on, right? We act like it's the worst day and it's just a feeling. And feelings change. They are information. And so we get to check in with each of you. Devin, I'd love to start with you.
Yeah, sure. One word. I'm going to go with, I'm both excited and anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Both things.
Okay. Appreciate you. Thank you. Yeah. Dr. Robin.
Full. Full.
Okay. Mr. Vance, how you feeling?
I feel very excited. Anytime I have a chance to, it's wonderful to be here without having a mic in my hand. It's wonderful to be here with my sister from another mister. We love to share, yeah. And this is what we do. So we're just excited to begin. Let's talk.
Yeah, amazing.
Let's talk.
Yeah. Oh, how am I feeling? I'm excited. I mean, I'm thrilled to have this conversation. I'm thrilled to be on this panel with so many amazing folks who I respect in terms of how you've been having the conversation. I'm ready for the juiciness. That's what I'm about. So anxious. I would say anxious and ready.
Okay. You want to jump in with your first question?
Yeah, let's come into it. So we're here to talk about masculinity, maleness, mental health, right? And I think that like that, those three terms when brought together come up a lot of things for a lot of different people. So let me just start there. What's the first things that comes to your mind in this moment when we say mental health, masculinity, Black men? What's some of the first things that come up to your mind? And just sharing that and like letting that be a springboard for our conversation. So I'll open that up to anyone on the panel who would like to start there.
I mean, the first word I think of is vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Sometimes like associated with the lack of, it's my immediate thought.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell us more? Tell us more about the vulnerability. How do you connect that?
Yeah, well, I think about mental health for Black men and I think how few spaces there are in which we show up and feel like we can show up whole, like feel supported, be able to vulnerably share when we are feeling sad or anxious or hurt and all these things. And like we so often contribute masculinity to like strength and stoicism and power and like having it all together. And the reality is like we're whole people. And so like, we don't always have it all together, and there's often not safe spaces for us to be held through our pain and vulnerability. And so that's like the immediate thoughts that I have.
Shay, I love that. Thank you.
You know, when I think of vulnerability, and I'm so grateful for you for this moment that we're co-creating. And as Courtney said, when he and I have the privilege of sitting next to each other, it's special. It's really special. When I think of masculinity in Black men, I think there's a quote that I use that says, starve the lie and feed the truth. And so I think of the prison, figuratively and literally, that many Black men, boys and men, have been placed in because of lies. So I'm thinking, you know, what lie do we need to starve today so that we can feed the truth? The other thought that comes up for me is, you know, I talk about that we all have holes, H-O-L-E-S. And I don't know if you're acquainted, and that's what you're talking about with your holes. It's like we're ashamed that we have holes, but our holes are a part of our humanity. And our humanity has been robbed because of slavery and sexism and racism and hatred of that which is different that we don't understand. But so we all have holes and we are longing to be whole, W-H-O-L-E, which is a holy H-O-L-Y journey. And so today for me is about inviting all of us, but particularly Black boys and men and those who identify with the trap of masculinity. We've made it just too small. And so when you're talking about, you know, the feelings that are not permitted, not allowed, I think today is about giving ourselves new permission to be with our wholes, longing to be whole, which is a holy experience.
All right.
Oh. Yeah.
The minister jumped out. I felt it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
So. My girl, that's my girl. And, you know, I didn't know. I mean, I was raised in Detroit. You know, we were my parents were all about education, and you know, I was everything, achievement made everything right. Harvard and Yale and all. But I didn't really, you know, the masculinity, I didn't really think about it because I was an athlete and I was a student. I was doing, you know, doing things. And so when I became, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I went to, when I got to Harvard, I said, we'll all figure it out together. And everybody seemed to know. And so I said, I want to try theater, because with theater, every time I do a show, I meet a new group of people, and I'm talking to the students, we would figure it all out together. And so I went, and so I thought, you know, into this acting thing, and I said, acting, I thought it was, you know, you're doing voices, just doing hello, how are you doing? I thought it was a thing. I thought that's what it was. That's what it was about. And I went to Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Massachusetts, and I got a Ford Foundation grant to be an apprentice, and the artistic director stood me up in front of folks. It stood all the apprentices, there were 15 of us, and said, she said, now I want you all to, we were all standing up there, she, and all the company was standing, the teachers and everybody was standing, sitting out there, and she said, now I want you, her name was Tina Packer, and Tina said, now I want you all to each of you, one by one, to tell me two things about yourself that you want us to know. And I said, God, I know what I'm going to say. And then she said, well, hold on. Then I want you to tell us two things about yourself you don't want us to know. I said, hold on. What is this acting thing? And so I really had to... It was so difficult. I had to shift my mind to access. I mean, because I was an achiever. My mindset was I can, you know, check off my list and keep it going. And this was something she was asking me to do to begin the process of being. Who are you? What do you feel? How are you? And then put that into your situation. And I was adrift, and so much so. And we were in the woods. We were at in Lenox, Massachusetts, at Edith Wharton's estate, and we were deep in the woods, staying communally, you know, with 15 other people. But it took, you know, and the stables where we were staying were really, really deep in the woods. And so I had to get out of there. And so I'm afraid of the dark. I'm afraid of the woods. And I was so stressed. And I said, I will venture out into the woods and feel my way tree by tree. And the lions and tigers and bears, oh my, were all around me. I knew it. And so I found my way to the road. and ran down the road a mile or so and got out there and just screamed, ah, okay. And I did that and I came back and felt my way back into the room and got into my bed. And just and next morning we were up and we were in class at 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning. We were in class and we were laying, touching sound, hum, hum, hum. And I, you know, I heard somebody, two or three people down from me, whisper, say, "Quit, hey guys, did you hear that moose out there last night?" And I, you know, it took me, you know, so much to shift, took me that entire summer to shift my mind to recognize that my emotions had to be a part of my life. And my emotions were not a part of my life. So I can only imagine. So eventually they became, and I could read the phone book and I could just, it would, things would just go right through me. And it's become, that's where you work hard so that your weakness becomes your strength. And it is, and so I can only imagine someone, because now I look for, when I'm looking for some work, I'm looking for something that, oh, I feel, I see that. I see that. I can read that. It's okay. That's the heat of the scene. That's the heat of the piece. Okay. I'm going to do that. But I can only imagine us men who have no outlet for their emotion. They have nowhere to go to actually release something either through a project, through a conversation, through, and so what do you do with all of that passion, all of that angst, all of that gifting? Where do we go when we have nowhere to go with who we are? That was a long story to say.
No, but it was a brilliant story, right? And I really want to draw those themes in because I feel like you all are telling different aspects of a similar story, right? So I hear, Devin, you're talking about the lack of spaces for vulnerability, right? What does it mean when we have Black men say, there's not a space where it's safe for me to be vulnerable, right? And then Dr. Robin's talking about the lie, right? The lie of masculinity. And then we have, Mr. Vance, you're bringing in this piece about really what sounds like almost this journey of masculinity, right? Like, you know, being in a space where I'm not attuned to my feelings. Now I got to go into the darkness of that, right? The radical, beautiful, because the darkness is also where the seed sprouts and where growth happens, right? And so I have to go through that to feel my way and how that can be horrifying for a lot of people. There's so much to just stay in a comfortable place, even if it's painful. And so I think that you're all telling different dimensions of the story. And it makes me think about something that I think is very connected to this, a story I often tell about my godson, right? Learning how to walk, like now what? God, Jesus, almost 19 years ago. Okay, he's grown. 19 years ago, right? And learning how to walk. And I remember we're at a barbecue. And you know, like, you know, the little toddlers, they don't know how to walk, so they're grabbing on the things and they kind of running towards you and like, they're going to grab onto something else. And at one point, he sees me, he's trying to come to me, but then he stumbles and falls, right? Doesn't hurt himself, but he starts crying, right? Like, just kind of just startled. And I go to pick him up. And immediately in the room, women and men tell me, put him down, he got to learn how to be a man, you're going to coddle him. Put him down. What you doing? You can't baby him. And I'm like, he don't know how to walk and poop on the toilet yet, but you need to be a man?
Yeah.
What makes you fix your face to say that? And I think about that is very connected to what happens to a lot of boys in our country, right?
Absolutely.
Is that very early on, you receive the message, shut down your emotions and your feelings. Honey, I can't even speak four words, but y'all telling me I need to learn how to be a man. My God.
Yeah.
What is happening? And then what happens? We have adult men who now have lived, who started, that message started when I was starting to walk. Now I'm 40, 50 years old, and somebody's like, well, why don't you talk about your feelings? Well, y'all told me not to talk about my feelings for 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, that's a big part of what happens in the socialization of many of us. And Dr. Rob, I'd love to hear you kind of weigh in on this. I know this is a big part of your work.
Yeah, no, it's so true. Every place where we go, I talk about when little girls fall, we pick them up and we kiss their boo-boo and we ask them what color Band-Aid they want. And then the boy falls and we scold him. We shame him. We blame him for being human. Because that's what, for having holes, for being hurt when he falls the same way that a girl falls. And so there is a systemic poison And that's really what it is. It's a poison that tells people, and I think it's even whatever dropped a phone, the reason I want to talk about that is boys have been distracted. So like that sound could have gotten us distracted. Boys have been distracted from their own humanity. Mm. And not only from their pain, but from their joy.
Mm.
I want us to remember that Black joy and masculine joy is something, as you were talking about, it is not only the vulnerability, because part of vulnerability is not just pain and not just tears, because tears are our teacher. You know, when people start to cry and they say, excuse me, I'm sorry. Mm. What are we doing? If we put sunglasses on when we are crying, what are we doing? We are saying that this part of me has no space and no place. But it is also true for joy. Mm. So that toughness, like, I don't really smile. Mm. And I will tell you, I won't say who it is, but I was in a group of all Black men giving a talk, and they were so serious and sober. And I told them a couple of things. One is that I never kiss and tell, so that they could not only feel safe to share their pain, but also their imagination and their joy and their expectation. And so I want us to realize that a part of reclaiming our divine birthright, and particularly for boys and men and those who are socialized in that way, it is to also not just reclaim, because for many people it is claiming anew, that I have the divine birthright to have joy.
Hello, I'm Donnie Frazier, Beam's Digital Content and Community Engagement Consultant. I'm thrilled to tell you about our program, Black Masculinity Reimagined. This community and skills building initiative supports Black men and masculine folks in addressing mental health and community violence. We offer events both virtually and in person across the country, where participants can learn new strategies for connection, coping, and self-care while working to dismantle patriarchy and support collective Black mental health. Learn more at beam.community.
And I just want to say one other thing about suffering.
Mm.
We know how to suffer.
Huh. All right.
We are so good at suffering. And there are reasons why we are good at suffering. But one of the things that Courtney and I talk about in The Invisible Ache is about breaking the, and it's these are my words, but breaking the addiction to suffering.
Mm.
It's an addiction that we don't understand. So whether it is as women and we say, oh, girl, I'm so tired. And we never think, well, I have a choice about what I'm doing that drains my tank.
Mm.
And the same is true for men, that there is a piece of what does it mean to decide that I am not going to be married to my misery.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to get divorced. Or from somebody that's
or we have to renegotiate the contract.
Come on. Ooh. Now. All right.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't have to leave. But we have to leave the way we are being.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
With ourselves. When Courtney talked about running in the woods, there's a quote that says, wherever I run, I meet myself there.
Mm.
So it doesn't really matter where I run, because I know for me, I have decided I'm going to move. I live in Philadelphia, but I'm going to move. I'm going to pack. I'm going to go somewhere. And then I get wherever I'm going, 3,000 miles away, and I open my luggage, and guess what's there? All my issues. They're all there waiting for me. And so we cannot outrun, nor are we meant to outrun. And if we understand that our holes are our longing to be whole, which is a holy journey, it is not something to separate ourselves from. It is something to acquaint ourselves with. Where do I hurt? Not, yes. Do I hurt? But where?
Where?
Where do I hurt?
I love that invitation for curiosity.
Yes.
Because in our work, this is one of the things that we always encourage people to do instead of assuming we know everything about ourselves.
Oh.
Let's sit in the understanding that there's plenty of things I have no idea about.
Yeah.
There are things about myself that I seek to learn. And it is only in the curiosity that we can do that.
And only in the moment.
Yes.
Because what I know about me now may not be true this afternoon. You know, when people say I've gotten delivered, and I will say sometimes and sometimes not, you mean in this moment you are delivered from anger or bitterness or self-hatred, but not the next moment, because I've got to live that next moment. And I may still be delivered, or I might find myself shackled again.
All right, now say it, say it.
Okay, all that is a woo. Got a woo, woo, woo moment. Because, like, right, all the wisdom and the brilliance is being brought down, right?
There's so many elements of this piece, and I want to nuance it a little bit. One piece that I want to lift up and really kind of re-invite us to in a moment of accountability to is we talked about, like, this prison. We talked about the lack of vulnerability. And then we talked about this, I give this example, the story of, like, you know, my godson. We have to recognize how we all are culpable in creating the prison of masculinity for folks, right? That, like, even as I think about in my relationships as a queer person, right, that I've dated men where I've tried to, I've seen that re-inscribe itself, right? I've had men even come to me and say, like, well, YOLO, you need to let me be a man. And I was like, huh. But then it was an interesting conversation because I was like, well, what is it? How can I let you be something that you already are?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you believe that being a man or being masculine is something that happens outside of you and not the core being of your spirit? And why am I responsible for it?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, but I think that's
some great stuff.
and I think it goes back to the ways in which men and masculine folks are taught that, like, what you do makes you a man, not who you are.
Mm.
Right. And I think that, like, it's sort of, and I want to complicate it because I think it happens across sexual orientation, across gender.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, the ways in which those psychological trap of masculine, because I think that, like, It's one form of masculinity, but we also have really beautiful forms of masculinity in our communities too, right?
Mm-hmm.
That not all of it's the rigidity and the hiding and the fear, but we've lost a lot of that in this kind of cultural moment, right? Devin, I'd love to talk to you a little bit about this, bring this conversation. When we talk about masculinities, right? Like, how do we nuance this conversation around masculinity and mental health? Because sometimes it can be very cis-centric, some heterosexual-centric, right? What are the nuances we need to hold to bring in?
For trans masculine folks specifically, oh, my goodness. I have so much to say regarding this topic. So I'm going to try to be mindful of time, but I'm going to bring it in. But yeah, there are just so many things that are specific to the transmasculine experience around mental health that people, I think, are just not aware of. You know, for transmasculine folks have some of the highest rates of depression and suicide attempts within the entire LGBT community as a whole, like with suicidal ideation being at like more than 50% easily. So it's like, you know, while there are trans people who come from loving homes, you know, that are supported by their families, too many of us are not. Too many of us are bullied by our families. We're, you know, forced to leave our homes early if we're not kicked out altogether. And so then that leaves so many Black trans men that I know who are, you know, caught at the intersections of anti-Blackness and transphobia, to where now if they're dealing with housing insecurity, job insecurity, food insecurity, you know, when you are, you can't get a job because you're trans, or you can't keep a job because you're experiencing transphobia in the workplace. I myself have had to leave jobs from experiencing transphobic harassment. Then you can't pay your rent. And when you can't pay your rent, you don't have a roof over your head, then the deterioration of your mental health for anybody who doesn't have a roof over their head is almost inevitable, you know? And so I really want to touch on that point. But then there's also this really huge component that I think is often, like, not acknowledged, which is the literal physical violence that trans masculine people are experiencing, both, you know, by, you know, regular strangers, but also our, like, domestic partners, also by police. Like, it's just ridiculous, you know, and all of those things are contributing to our mental health. You know, I live in New York City, which is supposed to be a very progressive city, right? And prior to me founding the Black Trans Travel Fund, I was running for many years social support groups specifically for trans masculine people focused around redefining and centering healthy masculinity. And primarily the people that attended my group were mostly all Black trans masculine folks. And the conversations that I had, the experiences that like other community is having has just broken my heart. Week after week to like have these boys come in and men come in and hear their stories of all ages, young to old, and literally being harassed on the way to my group for just something that was wearing a Trans Lives Matter pin. I've had been pushed downstairs, spit on, you know, like really physical violence. And so I think there's this assumption around the trans masculine experience that we transition into a position of safety because, you know, of course, we live in this patriarchal society. Patriarchal violence is something that is very much alive and real. And yet, because of that, I think there's a false dichotomy that has developed over time where this assumption that masculine people are inherently perpetrators of violence and then more feminine people are inherently the receivers of that violence, when in reality, there's a lot more nuance to that conversation. You know, I think that there are so many trans masculine people that are like being assaulted and murdered by police. You know, we're like experiencing domestic violence, seeing these transphobic and racially charged attacks on our lives. You know, I've been physically assaulted and arrested by police at Black Lives Matter protests. You know, I think about the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020 and like what a huge year that was for the movement, the different marches that were happening after the murder of George Floyd. And I remember marching for Tony McDade, which was a Black trans man that was murdered by police 2 days after George Floyd was murdered. But not so many people know his name, you know? And so I think about these things. At least 3 Black trans men just this year between March and April that I know of were murdered. And during that exact same time, span of a few weeks, just in my city, 3 Black trans men that I know, one was a friend of mine, were assaulted in the city. Two Black trans men were assaulted by a man at the club, sexually harassed them, verbally assaulted them because they were trans and they found them attractive, said all kinds of crazy stuff. And then my friend was also jumped by a group of cis Black women. And it was because they were originally trying to film him and he was uncomfortable with his body being filmed. And so he expressed that and it escalated into violence. But that violence originally stemmed from objectification, you know, this like desire of the body. And so the last thing I want to bring up is the fetishization that we are often dealing with as trans masculine people, especially Black trans masculine people, because we know that Black men in general are fetishized across the board. But trans masculine people have this very unique experience where we have been villainized for, you know, going against the societal expectations of gender and yet at the same time exotified for our transness, right? And so it's like I can't tell you how many times I have personally been sexually harassed by men and women alike who desired my body but had no respect for my personhood. And so I really, really feel like it's so important for us to be talking about like creating space for Black trans people's safety and vulnerability. We need so much more care than what we have been receiving. You know, like we also need and deserve protection. Mm.
So, Devin, I appreciate you. Sharing that. Wow. I appreciate you sharing so many of the things that you did because, you know, I think one of the critiques I have of my own community is the Black community is hella transphobic. In so many ways, right? Some of us go back home and we listen to our aunties and our uncles and our grandparents saying absolutely wild, ridiculous things. And I think it's such a call to action for each of us to really be thinking about in what ways are we making sure that folks in our community, all kinds of folks in our community are actually safe, are protected, yeah. are thought about, that whether we agree or not, mm-hmm. are we centering care?
Yeah. And I also hear, like, I hear it in Devin, and I hear you also saying this, Courtney, is that, like, there's this assumption, and it's interesting to have a colleague, Kenya Farrell, who's also talked about this often. He said, the way our binary operates, we kind of assume that there isn't a gendered violence that Black men experience. Is it a race, the fact that, like, no, there's actually a particular kind of violence that being in a Black male body or being a Black masculine body gets that needs to be named, right, and talked about. Like, whether it's emotional, where it's like,
I come to a space and maybe my partner is a cis heterosexual woman and I say an emotion and I'm immediately shut down as being a punk or being a sissy or something like that. Homophobia and transphobia right there, right? Or whether it's the ways in which, once again, like you see, all the ways in which we see that like transphobia and homophobia keep these things in play. Right, keep these systems in play and erase the real pain and harm that Black men and masculine folks are navigating. Right? And so I'm thinking about, as we like get ready to transition this into a Q&A conversation, I also think it's so important to name a couple of things, right? One, always important to name that just as we have a legacy of Black men who need to unlearn some things, right? We also have a legacy of Black men who are teaching new things and who have always done new things. Devin, your work with the Black Trans Trouble Fund is an example of that, right? Courtney, Mr. Vance, your vulnerability in your book and your honesty about your challenges and things you've navigated, you've opened up a path. You are not the first, but we are part of a history of that. I think we need to uphold that history and uphold that powerful work as we continue to challenge the transphobia, the femphobia, all those things, the rigid masculinity that's keeping and holding our folks hostage, you know, because it is contributing to negative mental health and outcomes and unwellness. So I'm curious. Go ahead.
I just want to ask Dr. Robin, we have a commonality early in my career. It was really important to me to work with incarcerated folks. Mm-hmm. And so I would go to prisons and jails and people would be like, girl, what are you doing? I'd be signing a waiver that said if something go down, they ain't coming to get you. And I was like, I'm going anyway. Right. And I'm really curious about, you know, in this journey of me going to prisons and attempting to teach men and masculine folks how to write poetry, that I was like, I think it's important that you have some liberatory tool. Mm-hmm. Even if you are caged, mm-hmm. you still have liberation and something no one can take away from you. Mm-hmm. I know that you have also spent time with folks who are incarcerated. And I'm curious from a perspective of a Black woman, there are things that I think inherently I learned mm-hmm. being the only woman in an entire facility of all Black men. There were things I learned day one. And I'm curious if there are things that you've learned in this journey that you think are really important to name, that maybe uniquely you kind of have a perspective, because I think we all have a perspective and it's important that we have the full perspective to really think about solutions.
You know, the one thing I would say about that is I learned not only how boys, because I worked with juvenile girls and boys, in a lockdown facility and the staff. And one of the things I wanted to really bring to light is not only that boys and men have been injured, but the way in which women have been a part of their injury. Mm. And that can be really hard for women to hear. Mm. So I say this not as a criticism or as judgment, but as real talk. Hmm. And part of being able to see ourselves is to not hate what we see. So if we have injured someone, not if, when. When.
It is.
It's not if, it's when. We have injured someone, and particularly as women, if we are raising boys, or living with men, whatever that might look like, how are we as women and as Black women aware of the power of our tongue, the power of our pain, the power of how we have transmitted some of the woundedness that is showing up in our communities? And so it's important that we become agents to challenge not only what's happening in our homes and our families and our grandparents, our parents, but also to challenge what's happening in me. And so can we be curious today? Can I be curious about what are the biases that I bring to the table? That's why they're called blind spots, because we can't see them. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be curious with compassion about our blind spots. Something that I would love for Courtney, before we go to questions, to talk about in terms of the invisible ache, and we're talking about masculinity, is your father's death by suicide and your godson, who was only 23 years young, because I think as we're talking about mental health, it is so easy because we know how to suffer, to suffer silently. And I'm just wondering, I mean, we talk about it in the book. Courtney and I both read the book as well for people who are maybe not readers in the same way, but you can listen. But Courtney, I'm wondering if you can...
Oh, you got one over there.
You got one over there.
Courtney, I already got you. I was thinking that same. But the reason is because when we're talking about the juvenile or the criminal justice system, it is full of Black and brown men who are injured and hurt, who had no space to take what happened to them or through them.
And I would add also, and not Black and brown men, but also a lot of Black and brown trans and queer folks.
Yes,
as well,
like absolutely. Absolutely. Names. Absolutely.
Well, one of the, and I know folks got questions, and we in a minute they're going to say, you ain't got to go home, but you get out of here. Just having somewhere to go. I mean, I eventually you're going to sit on the edge of your bed at 2 a.m. and with what your issues are, and you got to deal with it. I mean, we all do. We all know what we're dealing with. And my daddy didn't have any, he was a foster child. And so thought that his mother abandoned him. Mm-hmm. And she was looking for him her whole life, and he was looking for her. And he stopped looking for her because he was so hurt by it. So, I mean, what do we do? What do we do while we're waiting for our time? I mean, all of us have to deal with it. What do we do with ourselves? You know, my therapist, my mother challenged my sister and I after we finished getting my father's affairs in order for her is, you know, she said, I'd like you us all to go into therapy. And so we go back to our respective cities. And, you know, my therapist challenged me. She said, Courtney, how do you make decisions? I said, well, I flip a coin like everybody does. And she was feeling me out, just seeing where, you know. She says, Courtney, do you have the patience to let the mud settle in the water and the water become clear? Mm. I said, well, hell no. I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about? Clear water runs deep. What are you saying? I just want to go. I just want to, you know, so it's a tool thing, having the tools to know how to. I was in the woods and she helped me, a little Jewish lady, 5 feet from the ground. You thought it would be a Black woman or a man. I sat in front of a Black woman therapist for an hour, 45 minutes, and we just looked at each other. For 45 minutes, we just... And so the person, your people, don't have to necessarily look like you. They've got to get you. Mm-hmm. And I just want somebody... And that's what we're doing. We're, you know, trying to get, you know, your people around you, mm-hmm. you know, people that you know, we're going to do the thing. You know, the thing we did last, let's do that thing. You know, just your folks who get you. And I don't care what the color they are. I don't care
if they're sexual,
gay. I don't care what their sexual orientation is. I just want to be with people that we are, because my Bible tells me we're called to be kind. What is required of a man or woman? Kindness. And so you on your journey, you my father didn't find that. Mm-hmm. But my job is not to judge. My job is to love and to serve. And so I'm just trying to serve. And you know, that's what we give to our children who are about to young people, not children, which is prom nights, which is why I got to go. You know, this is, you are called to be of service. You're going to go out into this world. Mommy and I have done all we can. And now you can't say you didn't get it in the household. You got everything that you have to make a life with. Now we will be in support. We're going to be here. You go and see how this world actually works. Mm. And we all know the journey of little birdie and now you got to fly, you got to get out and just, and get out there and do your thing. So, you know, my daddy didn't get that opportunity. He didn't find it, but he gave me and my sister the best that we got to make a life with. And now the rest of it is up to us to recover.
Come on.
We got to recover it. We've got to, whatever you need to do. I just don't want to a white coat to sit in front of me and go, if you only had come to me. That means, you know, go bend over and get that prostate check. Go get the mammogram. Go get your teeth done. Go get, you know, take care of this vessel, which is of God. It's not me. This is not, this is, I'm just here for 70. And if by reason of use you get 10 more after that, it ain't nothing but pain. So do what you can do for, so that the your children see you taking care of yourself. Because they, you got to do, they, you can't do, what's the phrase? Do what I...
Oh, yeah. Was I mean, it? You know, when parents say, do what I say, not what I do.
Yeah.
Ooh, child, that used to run me low, that one. Right?
I gotta do it.
Yeah.
You know, so as we...
Thank you, by the way, for also making sure that our language is inclusive in this moment, so that we're talking, as you're talking about the invisibility and the violence, which is, again, it's in the air. And so we need to articulate very clearly and include when we're talking about men or men, and that's why I've said, or people who identify with masculinity, and you're talking about the trans community, you're talking about even in the church setting, because there is so much confusion, and maybe not so much confusion, so much condemnation.
Come on now, say it.
And so I'm... You know, I've often said, if you're going to judge me, I want to make sure that you judge me for what I believe and for what I stand for. And so it's important here today that we name, our victims. And we also name our victories. Because as you said, we are both. Yes. We are, but we are, you know, that men... And boys, however we identify, there is victory.
Absolutely.
And there is victimization, and that we name both. So, you know, just thank you for both of you for continuing to make sure that the language is inclusive, that we are being coached. And if we're not open, then we can't grow and become sensitive. I mean, when I'm in church settings and I hear language that is exclusionary, and it's connected to God.
Come on now.
I'm uncomfortable because I know it's injuring, and it is furthering the assault of people who are in that space and in that place who are taking it out. So it's just, you know, let us be open to someone not just correcting us, but teaching us, coaching us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I want to close out with this piece of a quote that I'd love to hear you all kind of respond to from The Invisible Ink, which, by the way, is a really brilliant and beautiful book. I thought it was such a good combination, Mr. Vance, for your story, to tell your story, and then having Dr. Robin come in and bring that in analysis. I was like, wow, this is such a really brilliant and accessible way to have this conversation. So this is a quote I'm going to share, and I would love to hear you all kind of respond to it or answer the question to it. It's from the book. It says, Mr. Vance says, my old way of coping, the escaping, the not dealing with the not dealing with it, the rising above, had gotten me to the age of 30. But I learned the old ways has taken me as far as they could take me. I had to do something different. And so my question for each of you is, what are the things that we need to do different? What are the things that need to be done different in our communities to make sure that Black men, cis and trans, gender nonconforming people who identify as masculine, all of us have sacred spaces, are protected emotionally, honored emotionally, that we are unlearning the rigid old ways of masculinity that reflect the colonial masters and reimagining a different way of being? What are the new ways and what are the new practices? I'd love to hear from you, Bob. Anyone will go first.
You go first.
Okay. Well, first thing I think of, I actually love what you were saying earlier, talking about how women contribute to like these issues. I think a big thing that I want us to focus on, like, you know, recognizing that like all people have the capacity to perpetuate patriarchy, right?
And come on now.
Violence. Like, there's a lot of patriarchal women out here. No shame.
Sure.
So I think like one, we are encouraging men to like express that vulnerability, but also like it's so important that we are challenging ourselves rather to actually hold men and their like emotions with more care and more softness. I think like just more tenderness, because we can say that we want well-rounded men in theory, right? Everybody talk about they want a man who expresses their emotions and is kind and all these things. But then in practice, if we're like not actually holding those like feelings of like anxiety or fear or sadness, all these things with care rather yeah. than like dismissiveness, which is so often happens, then like we are really not creating any we're not providing any possibility models for men to like provide emotional safety to other people, because emotional safety for themselves.
Wait, can you say that? Say that one more time.
Okay. Yeah. We, all people, including Black men, need possibility models for emotional safety. Mm-hmm. And we have not been provided that so often. So the challenge is for people who are not Black men and Black men to like do this for each other as well. Like lean into holding them with more care and tenderness, you know, just not. If you want us to have some emotion, move with emotional integrity, yeah. then like you have to like be willing to hear out all of the emotions and not. Mm-hmm. So.
And Devin, I love that you're saying that, because I also think we have to give people the opportunity to grow in real time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We are meeting people and expecting them to be perfect and whole and well. Right. And that is not how life actually works. And so do we have grace? Where is patience in our relationships? Where is the opportunity for redemption in our relationships? And I think sometimes, and particularly with social media and cancel culture and all this, we just want people to be a finished product the day we meet them. Mm. And the reality is we ain't none of us been finished products no day yet.
Right.
And so the same grace that we want and would hope for from our community, the question is are you leading a life that would produce that in the world? Mm-hmm. Are you a person who creates yeah. safety for people based on the way you live, the way you walk in the world, the way that you communicate? And I know for each of us, the answer sometimes is no.
Mm-hmm. It's
real. Right? We're creating more violence and harm. And so really the opportunity is to think about how can we be more caring? How can we see people as works in progress? Beautiful masterpieces in progress. Mm-hmm. And that might take us having to be patient, having grace, returning back to the conversation.
Yeah.
And I think we don't give that to each other enough.
Mm-hmm. I say. Yes,
yeah, that. Absolutely. Yeah. That's your quote. You want to...
No. Mm. You.
So what we can do is know the truth about ourselves first. Not pointing the finger. You know, they say if you point the finger at someone, you have the other four pointing back at you. And there is something about the other three, four kind of. The tools of self-compassion, because that's really what when you talk about grace, we're talking about self-compassion and not compassion. It's hard to be compassionate with someone else if our inner conversation is so hateful. Mm-hmm. You know, if you call yourself stupid or dumb or weak, it is quite likely that you can easily shame other people in that same way. But when you're tender with yourself, you have the propensity to be tender with other people.
Same.
And so I would just encourage us to practice good self-care, because if my tank is empty, it doesn't matter how well-intentioned I am. If my tank is empty, I have nothing to give. And so self-care is radical in our healing. It is radical in being able to create safe, sacred spaces where people can bring their wholes, longing to be whole, which is a holy experience. There's an African proverb that says the lion's story will never be known as long as the hunter is the one to tell it. And so I want us to realize that one of the ways we co-create a different atmosphere and a different environment is to not only identify the lions, the hunter externally, but we have made real the hunter on the inside. And so there is a cruel part of many of us that, again, it's a blind spot, but a part of being able to challenge something is, and remember I said, you can't challenge something if you are judging it. You can't examine something if you hate it or hate yourself. And so there is, this is an opportunity to be sweet and to be kind to the parts of you that are shattered and broken and still here. Shattered and broken and still here. So I want us to remember that sometimes the broken pieces, there's a passage of scripture in the book of Acts, and it talks about a shipwreck. And it says that people who were on this boat, that some of them got to shore because they could swim. But the people who couldn't swim, guess how they made it? It says they made it on the broken pieces of the ship. And so I want to remind you, the invisible ache wants to remind you, Courtney and I want to remind you that the broken pieces of you, there is redemption. There is possibility in the things that you trashed are actually like your life vest back into the power and the purpose and the converting your pain into, I mean, purpose in a way that will change and transform your life. And then we can create spaces that have room for everyone.
Yeah. I say, really said.
It was
take us home, Mr. Vance. Take us home.
You know, finding those things to do while you're waiting. You know, the journey when that was 34 years ago. My father died of suicide, and my mother hadn't challenged me and my sister to actually find a therapist, I doubt if I would have. And would I be ready for Angela 13, 14, 15 years later? Would I be ready for, no, it wasn't that long. would I be ready for her? Would the twins have come because I wasn't ready for, so, you know, it requires patience. It requires you to not look at what other people are doing while you're doing what you're doing. It requires you to be, you're okay where other people may be, God may be preparing them for a different path. I'm back here, and I used to see all my boys doing all their, you know, Don Cheadle, and, you know, everybody's doing their thing. And I'm like, okay, all right, I'm doing my dream work. Okay. But that's my journey.
Mm-hmm.
My journey is my journey. Be okay with you, boo. You're good. So that's you have to be, you have to intentionally say, all right, I'm here, and my journey is, I'm okay doing my work. And when it's my time to step out, that path will be for me, and everything will come to me. So it's really, you if you sabotage yourself, you'll never get ready. You know you need to do some work on you. So it's courage. Be courageous.
Yeah.
Be intentional. Be patient. Be loving.
And you're worthy of it. Mm-hmm. Worthy. You're worthy. You're worthy of it. I mean, is what I just also, when he talks about his mother, Mommy Vance, I call her, that what if she had said, and it would have made sense given when she was born and what happened in their family, if she said, never tell anyone. Mm. What happened in this house.
Mm.
We've all heard some, you know, what don't you ever tell anyone?
Mm-hmm.
Not only are you not going to tell anyone outside of this house, I mean, as you were sharing about being assaulted yourself, if people are saying, well, don't tell anyone that. I mean, don't ever let someone know what happened. And so we want to, the colonized mind. Mm. That's what we're really talking about. The colonized mind that wants to keep us in prison.
All right. Well, give a round of applause for our panel. Huh, that's the way to end, right? The colonized mind, right? Name that. You know, I'm a big believer in moving with spirit, and so we really had an opportunity to really sit and be present with this really dynamic conversation. The work of healing, reimagining masculinity continues, and each of you are a living embodiment of that work. And so much thanks and gratitude. And we are also a living embodiment, yes, of that work as well, right? Give yourselves a round of applause as you continue to work.
This has been Black Healing Remix, the podcast. Thank you for listening. And make sure to like, subscribe, and comment to let us know what you think. If you are looking for more tools and resources for your mental health and healing journey, make sure you visit beam.community for trainings, healing spaces, and much, much more. Until then, take care of yourselves and each other.